This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Just to rehash, J.P. Morgan really one of the ones we've obviously been front and center today, down 2.6%. So it's hovering near its lows of the session. And this is after I think it's safe to say, Tim, the most closely watched bank and certainly the most closely watched CEO of a bank on Wall Street. They did come out and they said it was a record in terms of making deals, a record M&A quarter. And that's and that's happening in the industry more broadly, kind of record M&A activity. But that certainly offsets some of maybe the downside of what we saw for JP Morgan.
But not enough for investors today. Loan growth still lacking. The bank does see some green shoots. The company's CFO emphasized that excess deposits are stabilizing. Analysts, though, on the call, they were quite curious how the bank intends to deploy its capital. What's its acquisition strategy with all these fintech players that are out there right now?
So she has been so busy. So just coming into the studio because she has been nonstop and probably up since the wee hours. Allison Williams, our senior global banks analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence here in our interactive broker studio. Thanks, because I know it is a crazy day for you.
And did you get in there like 4 a.m.?
Yes, I did. But this is just the warm up. Tomorrow we have 4.
I was just going to say. All right.
Today's sort of relaxed. And we have had, so we actually have had time to go through the numbers and such. I think you touch on a couple of key points, and really our takeaway is, you know, green shoots need to blossom.
So right. Will they blossom?
So there's a couple of positive signs. So the consumers are working down the excess deposits. So one of the reasons why we don't have card loan growth is because people are paying off their cards with their savings. So they're spending, but they're not borrowing. So that's why those excess deposits coming down are sort of a sign of, or a green shoot for the future.
How important is that as a revenue line for these companies?
So for JP Morgan and Citi, it's relatively important because they have more exposure to the card business. If you think about the yields on a card loan, the spreads are much better than some of the other businesses. And then the other area, sorry, I'm just going to move my mask.
She's got a mask on. She's got headphones. It's not easy.
You've got to wear a mask around.
So
the badge gets caught.
Following the rules. So so the other positive is that they're seeing an uptick in commercial line utilization. So that's an important read across for Wells Fargo and Bank of America.
What does that
tomorrow
mean?
So what that means is, you know, banks extend credit lines. Mm-hmm. During the crisis, we saw people borrowing on those lines, right? So think of it, people have like a home equity line of credit or any kind of letter of credit. This is available to you. And so banks or companies pulled down, they borrowed, then they paid it all back. And so use of those lines is very low because, again, the companies, like consumers, have a lot of cash. Mm-hmm. And so they're not borrowing. And so to the extent that you're starting to see companies use those lines, right, so they're starting to borrow against them, perhaps to finance inventory needs or other.
Wait a second. I thought the housing market was on fire and everybody's getting new mortgages at low rates and they're going out and buying really expensive homes because the monthly costs are low.
That is. And that's all good for origination volumes, but it doesn't necessarily transfer to loan growth because a lot of the banks are sell off those loans. So it's good for volumes. It's good for fees. But by the way, we're starting to get up some tough comparisons in those businesses. So
it is interesting on the commercial side, though, that if they are drawing on the lines finally, right? Because we've seen such a huge cap raise, certainly during the pandemic, right? Everybody was able
correct
because money was so cheap.
Correct. So we've seen, you know, massive raising of money by corporations. And what's interesting that we saw in the quarter was actually still some good debt fee growth because now with all this M&A going on, people are borrowing with those transactions. So there was actually some debt fee growth. Advisory, I think, as you pointed out earlier, that's really the highlight. Record fees, triple a year ago for JP Morgan, you know, up like big percent, I think it was like 50% from the prior quarter.
Hey, listen, also what's always a highlight, I feel like, is, the results. And let's point out, JP Morgan has been on a tear, up about 27% this year. So it's been a big bump to the upside. We've seen that with some of the big banks. what Jamie Dimon has to say about the world at large. I have to say, we're getting ready to go to Milken, and I was taking notes for some of the interviews and some of the panels we're going to be doing, because he's like, I'm going to spend whatever I have to on fintech.
That,
and I was thinking,
that was really the big, I think that, was a really big line. And I think that's the other thing that you've seen in JP Morgan's numbers. I mean, they raised their cost guidance something like $5 billion, like over the past year.
Yeah.
And we think that that spending is going to go up next year. But I think just him, you know, sort of making that statement, we have all kinds of competition, we're going to spend what it takes.
Yeah.
So sort of a mic drop, as my peer put it.
Yeah. Wait, spend what it takes to compete or spend what it takes to acquire?
Well, you can compete acquiring, right?
So
one of the things that the banks have done, or I guess two of the things that they've done, right, is that they, you know, they partners with fintechs, they buy the fintechs, they have, you know, these venture funds where they do different things. I think they kind of look at it from all angles.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we've talked about is this go around, right? So in the 90s, when there was the internet and they all kind of dismissed it, you know, this time around, the banks from the beginning, even with technologies like blockchain, or, you know, we're going to make sure that we're involved.
Except for Bitcoin. We know how he feels about
Bitcoin,
right?
Yeah, a little bit more controversial on Bitcoin.
Real quickly, I'm going to squeeze you 25 seconds. What we've got: Citi, Wells, Morgan Stanley tomorrow. What am I leaving out?
Bank of America.
Goldman Sachs tomorrow, Bank of America. I think Morgan Stanley's on Friday, but...
Oh, forgive me, yeah.
Strong equities trading, M&A fee strong, still looking for some more signs of green shoots on the loan growth side.
All right, sorry. You'll get sleep on the weekend or somewhere. Allison Williams, we love her, knows this industry like no other. She's Senior Global Banks Analyst here at Bloomberg Intelligence. We are lucky she's part of our team. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. So he writes today on the Bloomberg that, quote, perhaps the most important outcome today is that there remains little sign that inflation is turning around. Let's get a market perspective on today's hotter than forecast CPI report with us, Cameron Kreis.
Cameron's macro strategist and a contributor to the Markets Live blog at Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Westport, Connecticut.
Macro man, literally. Yep, he is.
Cameron, take us into the reading of today's numbers. It came in a little hotter than expected, but only a little hotter.
Well, I guess it depends on how you want to define that. Yeah, I mean, the headline number was came in at 0.4% on the month. The market had expected 0.3. The core reading, which is thought to give a better sense of underlying inflation, was 0.2, and that seems very well behaved. But there are a number of things under the surface that ebb and flow based on what's going on with the pandemic, say. But there are some alternative measures, such as those that sort of strip out the very lowest and the very highest readings, these so-called mean or median CPI. The Cleveland Fed has a series on that. And that actually rose by 0.45%, which is the highest in more than 30 years.
Wow.
And one of the highest readings in the last 40 years. So from that perspective, what that implies is actually that the scope of price rises is broadening out, and it's not just a narrow set of components that are impacted by the pandemic that are seeing price rise. This is exactly what you would expect if inflation is not, in fact, a transitory phenomenon, but is starting to build on itself as the public gets used to this idea that the price of everything is going up.
Well, and you know what's interesting, Cameron, in prepping for this segment, I wrote to myself a little note. When I'm not speaking to myself, I write to myself. But when are we allowed to say that inflation isn't transitory anymore? Like, what is it technically that happens where we say, no, folks, this is the environment, and it's going to stay with us?
Well, between you and me,
yeah,
you can say it now.
Okay.
You know, go home, lock yourself in the bathroom, look yourself in the mirror, and say it loud, say it proud. It's one of these things, you know, it seems like the only people that's not fair, but among the most, you know, the central bankers, the people in charge of policy, are the most prominent advocates of this notion that it's transitory, because they kind of need an excuse to do nothing. You could argue that given what the stock market's done, given what spending has done, that we haven't needed emergency settings for monetary policy for quite some time, but yet we've been full bore QE, and sort of one of the excuses is that, well, you know, all this inflation stuff that everyone's worried about, it's just transitory, it'll go away. And you know, in practice, life is transitory. You know, in the long run, we're all dead. And between
said
now
an
and
economist
then,
in the past.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, you know, everybody. So, this is the Sunshine Report.
So at some level, geologic time, all of human existence is transitory. Right? So it's an arbitrary construct that basically I think the central banks are using to mean until we're proven correct. But you are seeing some fractures in the committee. Some of the regional Fed presidents in particular have been pretty dismissive of this notion that you can just wave away price rises. And I would say that these are the people that are more in touch with sort of Main Street and the real world, because they have business contact they speak to on a regular basis.
Well, does it seem like from a policy perspective, the Fed is letting stuff run too hot?
I think so. And I think one of the reasons is that over the last sort of 30, almost 40 years, inflation and policy has been thought of from the demand side. We need to manage demand to get the outcomes we want on inflation. The problem is that this inflation shock is driven not just by demand, but also prominently supply. The supply side, you've had these supply constraints because of the pandemic that aren't going away. And when you match that sort of reduction in the supply with outsized demand, last sort of 18 months or so, that's where you get this sort of dynamic. And the problem with the risk is it becomes sufficiently entrenched, then that permanently changes or maybe not permanently, but substantively changes expectations and behavior. And this is exactly the phenomenon that we had in the 1970s, where there was an energy supply shock that was met with policy that said, well, we're not going to address this sort of head on because it's going to be ephemeral. But it influenced people's expectations, their wage demand. And the next thing you know, you had this sort of wage price spiral where people got paid more and they were willing to pay more for goods and services. The price of those went up. The people demanded more wages, and that just kind of fed on itself. And there's a risk that we're going to see the same sort of thing materialize this time around.
Hey, when it comes to wages, and I was just looking at your work, I mean, you point out real wage growth is negative using both hourly and weekly earnings series. And funny enough, there is a prominent shortage of labor. Perhaps the public is sharper than we've been led to believe. Because one of the things I thought about, I don't know if the Fed is watching, because they talk about inequities, inequalities. Certainly the lower end of the income strata, you know, has not seen the benefits that the higher end has seen, especially when it comes to wealth gains and wage gains. And so in a funny way, this shortage of labor has, you know, drove companies to increase what they pay, certainly hourly workers. And in some way, is that a benefit? But help me out here. Is there real wage inflation? We keep hearing about it. How do you see it?
Well, this is the issue, right? Yes, wage growth has been stronger than it has been historically. But if you get a 4% pay rise, but your cost of living goes up by 5%, are you better off? No. You can buy 1% less stuff. There's this phenomenon known as money illusion, which means that has historically been a tendency to say, well, I've had a wage rise of 4%. This is fantastic. But if the public is now aware, because of this narrative of widespread inflation, that 4% wage growth isn't going to cover the cost of living, then there's a problem. And, there's an argument that if people aren't compensated adequately, and you would say that negative real wage growth is not a particularly remunerative compensation, then the marginal propensity to actually work and save face exposure to COVID or what have you is less than if you have positive wage growth.
So Cameron, here we are. Earnings season has kicked off officially. We heard from Delta, we heard from Fastenal earlier this week, and we heard, of course, from JPMorgan Chase earlier today. Delta saying that fuel prices have risen 60% this year. The company saying that could really hurt what happens this quarter. What should we be on the lookout for when it comes to other companies that are reporting over the next few weeks when thinking about these pressures on the supply side and on the demand side?
Yeah, one word, margins. Yeah. If you know, the big question is if input costs are going up in terms of raw materials or in terms of labor, you know, companies have two choices. They can either raise prices and pass those costs on to somebody else, whether it's their business customers or their household customers, or they can absorb a hit to margins and essentially make less per dollar of goods and services that are sold. And in probability, it's some combination of the two. So I think the thing to focus on is to what degree are companies seeing a squeeze on margin, because that is obviously not a positive for the equity market.
Right. And that's when, you know, certainly if you're a publicly held market, you got to care, because, you know, if those margins start to diminish, go down, decline, you're going to get punished probably when it comes to your reporting season and certainly to the stock price. Hey, Cameron, thank you so much. Really some great insight into terms of some of that inflation data that we got today. Cameron Kreis, he's macro strategist. He's the macro man here at Bloomberg. He is a contributor to Markets Live blog at Bloomberg News, on the phone from Westport, Connecticut. Well, here in our Interactive Broker studio, 2 days in a row, I'm going to just say that Tim and I are super, super lucky, because Jenny Serain, she's our finance reporter here at Bloomberg News. She's got the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week this week. It's all about the relatively new CEO on Wall Street, not new to the company she now runs, but she certainly is making some changes when it comes to Citigroup. We're talking about CEO Jane Fraser. Jenny here in our studio. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Great cover story. First of all, tell us about writing this and kind of what you set out to do.
Yes, well, we set out to really tell the story of Citi right now, and we were fortunate enough to get an interview with Jane and have her kind of walk us through some of the big changes that she's got planned. They're just an interesting company. You know, they've had a really rough go of it recently, and I think they needed this fresh air and fresh blood, and they've got that, and so it'll be interesting to kind of see where she takes it from here.
Well, speaking of fresh air, I mean, the piece literally opens with fresh air, talking about an outdoor space that Citi has for employees, and also the way that Citi is different than the other majors in thinking about a return to work. Take us through what Jane Fraser is doing and why this is kind of crazy for what's happening on Wall Street.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So a lot of where this started was just we were hearing grumblings over and over again that people were leaving other banks and joining Citi simply because they really liked the way she talked about the future of work and what that looks like. And so, you know, she's doing the thing where they are allowed to work from home at least 2 days a week on a permanent basis. That's one thing. But I think the more interesting thing that she said is it's not just about this hybrid half in, half out situation. They're also being really flexible. So, you know, if it's 3 o'clock and you want to knock off and go pick up your kids from school or take them to a soccer game, that's fine. You know, log on later and finish your work up whenever you can. It's this whole idea of flexibility that people seem to really appreciate. You know, she's acknowledging that people are not just robots at a desk, that they're real people with real lives and really embracing that.
All right, so don't penalize me, because I really hate this. Is because she's a woman that she looks at it differently? Because that kind of makes me crazy. But there is that. But is it also a leader who's understanding that the world has changed because of the pandemic, and we have shown, certainly the big banks, how much they could get done home? Is it also, third, kind of her sticking to the other banks and saying, you know, it's a fight for competition. And so if this is what we have to do to kind of draw in talent, this makes sense.
Yeah, I think she's definitely unique in that she seems more willing to listen to her employees and has kind of let that guide a lot of her decisions, you know, since becoming CEO. And also she was president before that. So I think she's very unique. A lot of the other CEOs kind of get an idea in their head and stick to it and don't really let a lot of advice come their way, but I think she's very unique in that sense. And I do think, you know, it's a war for talent right now. These banks it's a very cutthroat environment for bankers, for traders, for engineers, for all sorts of different folks. And she's acknowledging that, and I think really kind of setting them apart.
I thought of the other cover story that was on Business Week. I don't know, was it over the summer, where it's like, basically, I don't get out of bed for $120,000 just to steal, you know, the supermodel line. But it was basically because we just continue to see, right, Tim, that Wall Street, the big banks, the big firms are upping kind of salaries for some of their, you know, starting junior bankers, whatever, you know, we just see that happening.
Well, when, Jenny, will we start to see this pay off? If there is this talent war, and we know this talent war is happening, when will we start to see the moves that Jane Fraser is making in terms of poaching talent and perhaps just as important, retaining talent?
Yeah, so that's the big question, I think, facing all of the efforts that they're making. They've already started to have some successes. There's been some big names that have left Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Google, and joined Jane in her big journey. And I think it's not just talent. You know, it's also this whole energy that she's trying to bring to the turnaround there, and really just trying to set them apart and set them on this path towards excellence is the word that they like to use, which is all, you know, to be fair, they are.
She did work for McKinsey.
She did work for McKinsey. She's
sorry, McKinsey, love you, McKinsey, but you know, right?
She's definitely. I mean, she has that consultant brain, and the yeah. You can kind of see a lot of that McKinsey touch in the strategy refresh that she's kind of venturing out on. So she's, you know, focused on wealth. She talks a lot about prioritizing high return businesses, deprioritizing the low return businesses. That's McKinsey.
Well, let's talk about it. I remember very early on in my career when Sandy Weill was at Citi, right? And he bought Smith Barney. He was making this financial supermarket company. And I remember under the red umbrella and like doing the whole thing, doing a stand-up. But what's interesting is wealth management, right? They lost Smith Barney eventually or sold it off. Is that an area they've got to be a bigger player in?
So Jane certainly thinks so. And I think, you know, if you look at some of the big success stories on Wall Street of the last decade, it was wealth management shops. Morgan Stanley bought Smith Barney and has since turned mm-hmm. it into this powerhouse. And so I think, you know, it's definitely a high returning business. Citi has long, you know, punched under their weight there. And so it's kind of an easy one where they already have a little bit of scale. They just got to invest in and get it a little bit bigger.
But internally, or do they have to acquire, or can they acquire? Is there anything out there?
They're a little bit hamstrung right now. They've, you know, last year they had the OCC and the Fed ding them for some longstanding issues with their internal controls. And so they're really limited in the amount of M&A activity that they can do because of that. Everything has to be run by their regulators. So I think they're, you know, really focused on an organic growth strategy with this. And yeah, wealth management, everybody's making lots of money there, so.
Okay, I know we already talked about work-life balance, but I'm stuck on this one quote that you include.
You do work-life, and I'll do the different parts of the business.
Because I was pretty surprised to read this when I was reading it this morning. She told you, quote, "The number of dads that came up and said, it's so neat because I can work from home and therefore I can get to the kids' school play." First of all, she called out the dads, right? Which was, I think, huge as a dad. And two, this is not Wall Street, right? This is not the Wall Street that's portrayed by the media, and certainly not the one that's been portrayed over the last couple of years, as we've seen so much burnout.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that's what is so fascinating, you know, to cover with Citi right now, and the just totally different tone we get from them than a lot of their competitors. And so I think she really embraces, she's a mom herself. She embraces that side of her and talks about it openly and talks about, you know, going part-time when she first had her kids as a partner at McKinsey. And I think she definitely brings all of herself to that role and encourages other people to do the same. And that's really what makes her kind of stand apart in a lot of these discussions. I feel like she brings a much more authentic and kind of genuine tone to it all. But, you know, at the same time, she's got a really tough job. So I think a lot of it is, you know, the communications and the approach, but then there's execution. And that's where we really have to see kind of going forward.
Well, execution is such a big thing. And again, going back to the pandemic, I think we were all shocked at how well things worked. And certainly the big banks, right? I mean, they did really, really well. Productivity returns as she continues to be really flexible. What is she seeing? What are they seeing in terms of Citi? And we'll get a read, right, in terms of earnings this week.
Yeah, so we have earnings tomorrow. So it'll be very interesting to kind of see how it all plays out. I mean, she said that they watch productivity very carefully, and none of what they've done so far has led anyone to slack off, and no one seems to be using the like extra flexibility to not work. At the same time, their returns are much lower than a lot of their rivals. And she
why
says,
is that?
I mean, I think a lot of it is just that they had more catching up to do. You know, they took the biggest bailout. They set aside nearly $1 trillion worth of bad, unwanted, toxic assets that they had to sell off.
From the crisis, from the financial crisis.
Exactly. And so that's, you know, that's a big pile of stuff to work through. And they've done that now. And that it's kind of the next step is here. And Jane is the one to lead them out of it. But it's definitely they're behind and they have to catch up. She knows that. She's pretty public about wanting to do that and crush the competition along the way.
What do analysts say is the right way to crush the competition to get to a point where they're actually valued like one of their peers?
And by that, he means Mike Mayo. No, I'm just kidding.
We talked about Mike Mayo yesterday at Wells Fargo.
Yeah, everyone wants to see them do better. I think the big thing that a lot of folks really want to focus on actually is their payments business. It's a little bit of a sleepier business, but it actually handles payments for most of the world's largest companies. So, you know, if you're a major company like a Coke or something like that, and you need to pay a supplier in Kenya or wherever, you lean on Citigroup. They're basically the only bank that can really help you do that.
Because of their international footprint.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so analysts want to just see them talk about that more and kind of give that size and scope a little bit better. You know, payments companies are super hot right now. They're getting all these fun valuations. Citigroup is sitting on this enormous payments business. Analysts just want to hear them talk about that more.
The international part, is it good that they're everywhere? I mean, because that's one of the things you get into in your story. Mm-hmm. They certainly put it out there that it is, right?
I mean, they're torn on it. Jane is in the midst of selling off about a dozen consumer operations in Asia and Europe. So they seem to be de-emphasizing that aspect, but they are very much emphasizing that they are staying in those countries from an institutional side. And I think, you know, it is something that makes them unique, the fact that they have these operations and can do payments and can, you know, sell to customers and be there for folks anywhere in the world. But it means that anytime something, you know, goes wrong in some far-flung place, Citi likely is there and has a view on it. And I think that sometimes gives investors a little bit of jitters.
Dare I ask about bank earnings? dare I even go there, Jenny Serene?
Ask away. All right.
So we know the card business. We talked with Allison Williams at BI. We know the card business is an important one, right?
Yes. Yeah. And what do you keep an eye on for later this week, especially when it comes to Citi?
I mean, cards. You know, we had JP Morgan this morning. They are also huge in cards, and they were seeing really big upticks in spending on cards, and it just didn't materialize into loan growth. So I think the big question folks have is, when does this turn into borrowing? Are people continuing to pay down their debts? And what does that mean for the way these businesses are structured and how these banks make money?
Is there something that... It sounds like you guys got to cover a lot of ground. Is there something that you would like more particulars on, or as you continue to cover Citibank and continue to report, that you will be watching really closely and think these are going to be future stories that I expect to come?
I definitely think the wealth management bet is an interesting one. And I love that she's going about it in such a different way, because I think that'll be really fun to watch and kind of see who ends up being right. You know, Morgan Stanley, they like this big asset manager. They've married it to their wealth management business. So their asset manager is churning out products, and this fleet of brokers will sell that for them. She's going on a very different path. And so I think that's, you know, a fun storyline to keep on track of and see who's right, you know, who ends up making more sense as we all go more digital and also just the insane explosion in wealth that we're expected to see around the world. It's going to be interesting.
What's she like? And the reason I ask is I think about the recent meeting that Biden just had, President Biden, with the big bank CEOs, and they were talking about the debt ceiling, and she was the one who spoke first. And so I thought that was pretty impressive. But what is she like as a person in terms of the feel that you got from her and the time you spent with her?
Yeah, I think she's a really genuine, authentic person. I think Mike Mayo in his note this week, he said, he used the word change agent, and I think a lot of folks get that vibe that she's there and is ready to put her own stamp, and she's very much willing to kind of go her own path to do that. And so I think people respond to that, and you know, it's working on the recruiting side. We'll see how it goes on the retention side. But I definitely think she's the fresh air that everyone talks about.
What do other big bank, final question, big bank CEOs, what do you hear, like, kind of back channels?
I think everybody has their own flavor. I mean, Jamie Dimon is Jamie Dimon. He's very out there and very outspoken. And I mean, he's been in the seat for so long. And so he's kind of like Father Time on Wall Street. So she's new and she's different. She's definitely not, you know, Jamie. So I think that's the big difference here and what we were trying to capture with the piece this week and just show, like, there's someone new. There's a new sheriff in charge at Citi and they've got a lot going on.
Definitely a different feel.
Do we see Goldman Sachs and other banks adjust their hours and adjust their schedules for their bankers as a result?
I don't think so. I mean, they just seem so adamant.
All right, we got to run. Yeah. Sorry, forgive us. Great cover story. Jenny Serene, we love it, on Citibank and Jane Fraser.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
Drive the rain, shake the brake, we can't relax.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funk music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so we've got about 10 minutes left in the Wednesday trading session. Lucky for us, back with us is JJ Kinahan, Chief Market Strategist over at TD Ameritrade, joining us on the phone from Chicago. We do this as we see stocks definitely off their lows of the session and really the momentum coming out of the tech sector as we've seen certainly yields come down, particularly that 10-year bond coming down. Hey, JJ, nice to have you back with Tim and myself. What are you guys talking about at TD Ameritrade today?
You know, I think everybody was very interested in the start of earnings season, primarily. Mm-hmm. And I would say that although the stocks maybe haven't responded, we were off to a good start overall in terms of what the financials kind of laid out for us this morning. And, you know, Delta maybe...
It's a good start. JP Morgan's down a little bit.
I know. As I said, the stocks are down, but I think that the overall tone of the earnings was still pretty good. There's no question about that. JP Morgan, BlackRock down a little bit, no doubt about it. But, you know, I think there were some worries going in that what if the financials have issues also? Because I think most of us are expecting that as the earnings season goes on, particularly as we get toward the tail end and we start to get more retailers, it's going to be very difficult because of, you know, you talk about supply chain issues on the show a lot, and that's something that's going to come into bear, and I think it's going to be very difficult for some of those CEOs to put a real positive picture around that, particularly as we head to the holiday season. So I think the fact that the financials came in, yes, the stocks are down. We know there were a lot of expectations around the financials. I think we're going to continue to see that pattern over the next few days. A lot of expectations, tough to meet those expectations. But the tone of the earnings calls, pretty positive overall. And the growth continues, but at a slower pace.
Okay, even Delta Airlines? I mean, shares down more than 5.7%.
Yeah, the airlines, as I said, I'm sorry, you know, the financials I thought were good. The airlines, this one's a little bit tougher overall, right? And I think we may see a similar pattern for some of the transportation companies. Let's face it, their biggest input in most cases is gasoline. Yeah. And we know what happened with gasoline. And we also have, you know, the Southwest story seems to be a little bit more stock specific rather than an overall airline story. However, the you know, maybe a little bit of a slowness of people taking up domestic travel. And I think the other thing that's really may hurt the airlines is, you know, anecdotally, I travel a lot for business. I just think business travel is continuing to be taking a little bit longer to get back on track than the airlines expected. And now you're at this time of year where a lot of family holiday travel is over because the kids are back in school. Business travel hasn't picked up necessarily to the level that I think many of the airlines would have expected. So it's a tough time for them.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, Carol and I are actually jumping on a plane tomorrow for the first time. I traveled for work once over the summer, but yeah. Carol, you haven't traveled for work in,
no.
What, 18 months?
February 2020, Super Bowl, we were doing some stuff down in Miami, a big broadcast and a Bloomberg Live event. That's it. I have not been on a plane.
That's almost 2 years.
I mean, I had to, you and I were talking about TSA. I had to like re-up my thing because it expired.
I'm not waiting for you at security. No.
I know you're not. JJ,
just kidding. I will wait.
We'll see. The supply chain problems, inflation problems, transitory. If these things are a bigger dislocation, that's just not a temporary thing, that this becomes part of the new norm, what does that mean for our environment? Is it a case of an uncomfortable adjustment for a few more quarters, and then it just becomes part of the way things happen? Or, I don't know. Or, well, yeah, how do you see it?
Well, so inflation, you know, is, in my experience, is something that kind of just goes slowly, 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 and then all of a sudden. And so, you know, you see the reaction in the bond market today in terms of maybe not as frightened, I guess, about it. Because bonds being higher, yields being a little bit lower, that would tell me that people aren't as frightened about it. But, again, This is one day where we are having this big move. I certainly don't think you can say inflation is over by any stretch of the imagination, but it's just such a strange time. The supply chain, you know, L.A. ports going 24/7, hopefully that helps. I really don't think we start to see the true effects of that until for another probably in about a month to a month and a half, I think we'll have a real clear picture. Why? Because at that point, holiday shopping season should be in full full level, so to speak. And if there isn't things that people can get delivered quickly, or probably more importantly for many of these stores right now, this is why you have a brick and mortar store is usually the holiday season. And if there's not the things on the shelves that people want, that unfortunately could be another death knell for many of the brick and mortar stores.
Hey, speaking of the holiday shopping season, Apple shares taking a hit today. Not that big, just down close to half a percentage point right now. This on our colleagues report that it'll likely slash its projected iPhone 13 production targets by as much as 10 million units. We hit that hard yesterday. How did you read into that news and Apple's ability and other companies' ability to successfully navigate the supply chain issues in the fourth quarter?
Well, you know, Apple obviously is superior at it. But one thing I will say, Tim, in terms of just how our clients trade that stock, Apple and Microsoft are in a little bit of a category unto themselves. And the reason I say that is they get a unique benefit. Many people, you know, seeing them as blue chip, mature companies, which they are. So when we head to the downside, a lot of retail traders will go to those two stocks for, you know, air quotes, safety. However, when things get better and we start to see the in tech stocks starts to go up, they also go to them for growth stocks. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me actually that the bad news there isn't met with some, a bigger reaction than it is, because again, this is one when we talk about the buy the dip as has worked for many people over the last, you know, 8-10 years, pick your time frame. This is one of the stocks that usually from a retail perspective is one of the first leaders in terms of buy the dip. So people are looking for opportunities. If Apple, this isn't one where Apple goes down, people say, oh my God, right, I gotta get rid of it. This is when Apple goes down, people say, I gotta get more.
All right, gotta run. Hey, be well. JJ Kinahan, Chief Market Strategist at TD Ameritrade.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.